Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But please do not call for the time being until I ask for calls, because we have with us Professor Buzyshevsky, and we're going to be talking about his book, What We Can't Not Know. Now, we've had Professor Buzyshevsky on before. He is a professor at religion and philosophy at the University of Texas. He's the author of a number of books, but he really has a fascinating background, because he didn't start out writing really from a Christian perspective. He really was, certainly, as so many people educated at the universities, like I was when I was there, had no faith much of anything. We were looking for a rational explanation for everything going on. I'm going to let him tell you a little bit about his story and how he came to the philosophy that he espouses today. Would you just like to sort of introduce yourself to our listeners, and we'll pick up from there?
Sure. Now you want me to head right into the story that you promised them, or do you want to leave that for later?
All right. Well, why don't you head into the story with it?
Okay.
And then we'll, of course, get into the philosophy behind it, because it's so simple. Why do they make it so complicated?
Well, I'm a professor of government and philosophy at the University of Texas. I do mostly moral philosophy and political philosophy, and I deal with the intersection of these subjects with religion, as you mentioned. When I first was in school as an undergraduate and later as a graduate student, I was not a believer. I had abandoned the Christian faith of my boyhood. And I'm the sort of person who tends to take things to their logical consequences. So after giving up belief in the lawgiver, I very quickly abandoned belief in the law. If there was no God, it seemed that the moral law couldn't be valid either. There was really no grounds to say that anything was right or wrong. Whose command would it be? Something might seem to be prudent, or it might seem to be something that you wanted to do. But I couldn't give any explanation of why you should want one thing rather than another. So really, I was not just an atheist. I was a sort of a nihilist. I really had abandoned all possible rational grounds for judgments about good and evil, about right and wrong, about value, about meaning.
Well, isn't this really what so many philosophers have done, is they've thought with their own intellect, try to come up with a rational explanation for life and how to live our lives?
Well, it is what many people try to do, and I still believe in trying to, philosophy is trying to explain things according to reason, but, you know, it isn't reasonable to, it isn't reasonable to reject the things that I rejected. And it also isn't reasonable to reject faith. Faith is beyond reason, but it is. But there are a lot of things that we accept on faith. I may believe my friend. I may believe that what he's telling me about something that happened to him is true. Can I prove that? Can I come up with an ironclad proof that he couldn't possibly be lying to me? He couldn't possibly be deluded. No, I have confidence in him. There is some faith here, but it may be a reasonable faith. It may be well grounded on my experience with him in the past.
All right, well, I'm going to have to toll that we're going to just let some of our listeners go and take on some new listeners. We'll be here in just a moment, right here back here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay. Our guest this afternoon is Professor Buzyshevsky. He's a professor of religion and philosophy at the University of Texas, and he's written a book, a fascinating book called what we can't not know. Now, I've had the privilege of interviewing the professor before here on Radio Liberty, but I think his message is an important one. It's one that we have to think of over and over again, because like Professor Buzyzewski, I had given up my faith when I was in college, and then, of course, as a graduate student, and of course then as a teacher of philosophy and religion, why he began to question some of the things that that philosophers do question. How do you explain how we should live in our lives? You know, is there a rational approach to that? And I'm going to let you sort of pick up your story from there.
Yes. Well, the problem that I faced when I stopped believing in anything when I was a student wasn't simply that it drove me to despair, although that was true. It was also that it was unreasonable. It meant that I had to ignore things that were right underneath my nose. Conscience tells us some things. As a matter of fact, there are some things that we can't not know about good and evil, about right and wrong. It's impossible not to know them deep down. I knew them too, but at the surface of my mind I was denying them, and that tied me into knots. It tore me into pieces intellectually. When there came a day when I recognized, although at this point I couldn't really explain it, that there was something objectively wrong with evil, you could even say, about my own condition, and that intuition grew stronger and stronger and stronger, until I had to concede that this was knowledge. It wasn't just a feeling. There was something about a real evil here, and if there could be a real evil, there had to be such a thing as a real good, that evil is the distortion of or the deprivation of. There must be a real wonderful, of which evil is the is the loss. So I restarted to rethink everything. Now, in my case, coming back to common sense and coming back to faith, which goes beyond common sense but includes it, and all of these things happen pretty much at the same time. In my case, for some people, they happen over a longer period of time, strung out step by step. But for me, it was fairly well compressed over a period of about a year, and I did find at the end of this time that I'd recovered my belief that there was a real good and a real evil.
Hold that thought there for just a moment here.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this afternoon is Professor Buzyzewski, and we're talking about, of course, his book, What We Can't Not Know. And he talked about his period of course, turning away from God or belief in right and wrong and absolutes, and then of course, recognizing the evil that was in the world, the evil that was in each of us, and then realizing that there was evil, there had to be a God, there had to be good, and if there was good, there had to be a God, and there had to be absolutes, and there had to be something there that, of course, people have known since the beginning of time. And you can even go into areas where they're natives who've never had any contact with the outside world, and they have their worship of gods. You can read the Iliad and the Odyssey written by Homer, and they recognized there were gods. They didn't recognize the God that we did, the Christian God, or the God of the Bible, but they knew there had to be a God, and that without God, why, man was hopeless, and man had to have his gods to be able to live, or else you would have a total moral anarchy. So why don't you sort of pick up the story from there as you begin to then to come back to God and to begin to looking for an explanation of all the unexplainable things that people have pondered about for so many years?
Well, there are some things about our moral experience that don't make any sense unless there is a God. In the first place, why should there be a good and evil at all? You know, atheists are very fond of teasing religious people and saying, well, you know, if there is a God and he's good and he's all powerful, like you say, why is there evil? It seems to me that the atheist has a much bigger problem. His problem is not to explain why there is evil, but how there could even possibly be good. How there could even possibly be a difference between good and evil, if it's the case, as he believes, that nothing is real except matter in motion. Right and wrong are not properties of matter. Good and evil are not properties of matter. Meaning is not a property of matter in and of itself. You know, these are things which require a mind. There must be a mind behind everything, a creative mind. You know, we also see, when we look at reality, we see all sorts of evidence of design. Not just in our bodies, for instance, in the obvious purposeful arrangement of things, but there's a moral design to us too. We seem to have been designed for family, designed for marriage, designed for the potentiality of caring for others and caring for children. And when we go against the grain of our nature, we're going against the when we go against the grain of this moral design that's built into our nature, we're violating the purposes of the designer. I don't know how you would explain this design if you didn't acknowledge that design comes from a designer. You know, when an archaeologist digs up things from ruins, he can tell the difference between a rock and something that seems to have been designed as a tool, let's say, or as an object of worship. When a forensic pathologist has a body in the examining table, he can tell the difference between he can do pretty well at telling the difference between marks that were produced by chance, marks that were produced by disease processes, and marks that would have been produced by a blunt instrument. He can recognize the signs of design, of purpose here. And in the same way, we can look at many aspects of the universe, not just marks on dead bodies, not just objects dug up, and say, I see signs of human design and purposefulness. But we can see in the making and in the patterning of the creation itself, the signs of the design of the supernatural purposer, designer, creator, God. And I think that this is a reasonable faith to hold, because it explains things more fully and more adequately than they could otherwise be explained. Do you see that God? Do you touch him? Do you feel him? No, and so of course a faith is still required, but it is a reasonable faith. It's a faith that makes sense. This is why we do accept explanations of anything, because they do make sense and explain the thing to be explained better than the alternative explanations do.
A great deal of your book deals with this concept of the natural law. Would you like to explore that? Because this is something that goes back, you know, many hundreds of years, and yet people have always accepted that there was a natural law, and that of course this natural law came from God. And if we begin playing games with that and avoiding it, violating it, we lay ourselves open for terrible, terrible problems. What is natural law, and why is it so important in your philosophical view?
Natural law is a philosophical name for the moral law. Now, if we already have this phrase, moral law, why would we call it natural law? Well, in calling it the natural law, we're calling attention to the fact that we didn't invent it. It's not something that we made up. It's something that's already laid into our nature, built into us. How is it built into us? Well, first of all, it's built into the deep structure of the human moral intellect. We call that our conscience. It's built in there. There are some things that, that you can't not know. It's impossible to not to know. It's impossible not to know, for instance, if you have a normal human mind, the wrong of deliberately taking innocent human life, of murder. And there are other things that are built into our nature in other respects, our emotions, the ways that we can be shaped, and the ways that the human material really doesn't want to go. Show that we seem to have been designed with a view toward sociality and family, certain types of relationships and of cooperation. So when we go against the grain, either against the grain of what's built into our capacities and emotions, or what's against the grain of what's built into our conscience, or what's built into the grain of the... You notice that there's a certain arrangement of natural consequences for our actions too. That's part of the design too. When you go against the grain of any of this, you are asking for trouble. You're not just doing what you recognize is wrong and incurring guilt and consciousness of guilt, but you're also messing yourself up in other ways. You destroy families, you destroy happiness, you destroy peace between people and good order in society. And human life becomes hell on earth.
Well, one of the questions you ask is, can you be good without God? And I hear this from the atheists all the time. Well, I don't believe in God, and I'm a good person. Well, of course, how do you respond to that?
Well, now, I don't want to, on the one hand, I certainly don't want to deny that an atheist has a conscience. If what I'm saying is really true, that this is built into the human moral intellect, then we can't unbuild it. You know, if it is a natural part of us, then even holding a view like atheism, like I used to hold, is not in itself going to destroy conscience. However, the atheist is going to have a problem because he can't explain why there should be such a thing as conscience. He may say, oh, well, these are feelings that we got because of evolution. Well, in the first place, they aren't feelings. There are matters of knowledge here. And in the second place, if this is just something that happens because of evolution, well, to say that is to say that your conscience is a meaningless product of a blind process that did not have us in mind. And so why should you even call it a conscience? Why should you regard what it tells you as having any meaning? Why shouldn't you say, well, I have an inhibition against murder, but that's purely arbitrary. If evolution had gone a little bit different, I wouldn't have this inhibition. And so the smart thing for me to do is simply to ignore it. The atheist can't answer those questions, really. He is also going to have a series of other problems. I believe that I'm not just an abstract theist, somebody who believes in some sort of a god. I am a Christian. I believe that, in other words, that from the beginnings of human history, we human beings have rebelled against God, but that God offers a possibility of redemption, offers a path back to Him. This is the gospel. Now, if you're an atheist, you've got all of the consequences of that brokenness, but you don't have the path back. You don't have the divine assistance that we all need, because we're all pretty well messed up. We may as well be honest about that. We all need help in being decent from day to day. We're not as decent as we like to think. You know, the question that you asked me, a student once asked me, he came into my office and he said, you know, if something came up in class today about God and about God as the author of moral law, he said, why would that have to be the case anyway? He said, you know, I don't believe in God, but he said it just like you put the question hypothetically. I think I'm a pretty decent person. And I said, well, okay, how decent are you? Do you think that you could go a week without an envious thought, or without unjust anger at somebody, or petulance, or resentment? How about lust? Do you think that you can go a week without having any thought of being in bed with that pretty girl there who isn't your wife, or who is somebody else's wife? And he said, well, no, I guess I can't. I said, do you think that you could go a day without any of that? And he began to look sort of uncomfortable. He admitted that he couldn't. And I said, do you think you could go 10 minutes? And I confessed, I don't think I can. I need God's assistance daily. So if we say, well, I think I'm pretty decent, our standards are much, much lower than God's standards here, which are the standards of perfect holiness. We're just used to setting the bar low, and we call that low bar that we imagine that we can achieve being decent. And it isn't a very high bar in the first place, and even so, we aren't really reaching it.
And, of course, that was what St. Augustine was talking about 1,600 years ago, that man was, very nature was depraved.
Yes, he said not his nature in the sense that that's how he was designed or that's how he was made, but in the sense that, so to speak, by rebelling against our designer, our maker, the crafter of our nature, we'd thrown a monkey wrench into the works. So I think that his line about the typical attitude that a human being has in those circumstances is very widely shared. Before his conversion, he said, God, make me continent, make me chaste. Not yet.
Well, you know, these ideas, they've been around for a long time. The big problem is we just don't teach them to the young people today. And, of course, they make so many mistakes because nobody's telling them that there are certain things that we can't not know. We'll be right back here in a moment with our special guest here at Radio Liberty.
Have you ever wondered what really happened in Oklahoma City? Well, a very important video is the cover-up in Oklahoma City. And it really consists of film clips that were actually taken from video footage shot during the first 2 or 3 days after the bombing. And you'll actually hear the commentators in Oklahoma City talking about the second bomb, the third bomb that had been disarmed. Now, if they were actually disarming bombs, why didn't we hear that throughout the rest of the country? You'll actually hear an interview with one of the gentlemen who was in the Murrah building at the time that the bomb went off, and he had time then to jump underneath his desk before the blast blew in from outside. Obviously, there were two bombs, one inside, one outside. Call 1-800-5-HIV-1.
It is vitally important that you help us to get this message out across America, because without knowledge, my people perish.
This is health journalist Bill Sardi. In November of 1991, the 60 Minutes television show first reported on the French paradox. The fact the French violate every dietary rule for good health, eat a diet rich in fats and calories, and yet exhibit far better cardiovascular health than North Americans. Over a decade later, we know that molecules called polyphenols are responsible for the health benefits in red wine. But those molecules only remain stable in a sealed bottle of red wine. Longevinix is the first dietary supplement to stabilize red wine molecules in a sealed capsule, just like a corked bottle of red wine, providing red wine polyphenols without the calories, alcohol, and sulfite preservatives. One Longevinix capsule is equivalent in polyphenols to drinking 5 glasses of red wine. Call 866-405-4000 today to order Longevinix. It's a revolutionary dietary supplement. 866-405-4000.
Hi, this is Dr. Tony Thierry. Are you one of the many people who take vitamin supplements? Do you take handfuls of pills each day to increase energy, reduce your pain, or improve your overall health? Now there is a better way to get the vitamins and minerals your body needs in a delicious-tasting whole food liquid supplement, Body Balance. Body Balance contains 121 essential vitamins and minerals and is made from only organic and natural sources. Developed by doctors, Body Balance was originally available only through healthcare professionals. Now this incredible whole food liquid supplement can be delivered directly to your home. Body Balance offers an extremely effective method to feed your body towards wellness, and we're confident you'll love the difference your body feels. To order your Body Balance, call me directly at 1-800-768-9763 and try it risk-free for 45 days. Again, that's 1-800-768-9763 or online at healthyfoundations.net.
Hi, this is Joyce Riley, and most of you now know why so many people agree that Miracle 2 soap really is a miracle. Miracle 2 products are now being used by farmers and ranchers to increase their yield. Mechanics and machinists use it in their shops. Chiropractors and physicians are using Miracle 2, and the uses are simply too numerous to mention. Dr. Stan and the folks at Radio Liberty knew right away that the listeners would benefit tremendously by using Miracle 2 products. You can enjoy the benefits of Miracle 2 and help Radio Liberty continue to broadcast Dr. Stan's message by calling 800-544-8927 to order your Miracle 2 today. After you've tried Miracle 2 around the house, you'll probably do just what so many others have done. Get rid of all those toxic cleaners and chemicals under your sink. Call Radio Liberty and order your Miracle 2 today. 800-544-8927. 800-544-8927. Dr. Stan Monteith and so many listeners know that Miracle 2 soap isn't just soap. It's a miracle.
Well, Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this afternoon is Professor Bozesinski, and we're talking about his book, What We Can't Not Know. And, of course, there is one point that he certainly makes here, talking about natural law, and then he goes on to say that there are certain things that everyone knows, whether they're atheists or not. It's sort of ingrained into us. Sometimes we can suppress this information, but there are certain basic things that every human being knows one way or the other. They know that it's wrong to murder. You may very well go ahead and do it, but you know way down deep in your heart that it is wrong. And you say that really that was the title of your book, What We Can't Not Know.
That's right. That's right. The moral truths that we're talking about are pretty much the Ten Commandments sorts of truths. Many of my students or and other people that I speak with from time to time, if asked, well, how do you know what's right and wrong? They may, if they're religious people, they'll say, well, I know that from the Bible. The Ten Commandments are there. Now, I'm a Christian. I believe in the Bible, but it's a striking fact that cultures that have never heard of it are aware of these same moral principles. Cultures that have never come in contact with any of these biblical teachings are still aware that it's wrong to murder, it is wrong to commit adultery, it's wrong to steal. They know these things. They know that it's right to honor God. Even in cultures where you have polytheism, where they may worship many gods, there's a sort of a dim awareness behind that all of some kind of a high god that they might not worship, but that they know he's there. It's as though there's a sort of a guilty conscience that they ought to be worshiping him. There is a general consciousness of these same moral principles in all times and all places all over the world. I think it is impossible not to know them, because the things, well, I call them the four witnesses, the means by which we know them, those things in our nature that instruct us about these things, are built into us and inform people everywhere.
Well, now, Chris, what's gone wrong then in our society? Why are so many of our young people into and all sorts of aberrant behavior, whether it would be drugs or sex or alcohol or just sort of rebellion against everything?
Well, sure, it's a rebellion, but there's but that only provokes the further question: why would people rebel? Why would you rebel, for instance, against the moral norm that says that sex ought to be confined within marriage, that's what it's for, this procreative partnership, this intimate bond? Well, obviously, because we imagine that we're going to be happy, that we're going to have more pleasure if we just yield to the sexual impulse we want whenever we want to, and that's a lot easier, isn't it? It doesn't take any discipline. It doesn't take any moral fortitude. It doesn't take all the work that is necessary to delay gratification and to resist your desires. It's so much easier to just go ahead and do what you feel like, and therefore so tempting to believe that this will make you happy. The problem is that it doesn't. That was the experiment of my generation. You know, we invented the sexual revolution, and it was a catastrophe. It didn't make people happier. It made people miserable, and it made people in the second generation even more miserable than in the first, because they were now the children of the people in the first generation and were suffering from all the damage that the people in my generation did to their families, and did through the chaos that they were wreaking by their own upon their children through their own sexual experimentation. Now, when we look at other forms of rebellion, a rebellion against property, against the moral law that it's wrong to steal, to take what belongs to another, you know, you see the same kind of thing. There's always a motive there. We imagine I'll be happier this way. This is just a restraint. We imagine it as a kind of a fence that's around us, and it's keeping us from our happiness. And if only I could have that stuff over there that belongs to him, if only I could get it from me, I'd be happier. But it turns out that these fences are like the climbing rods, that we see the rods all right, but we're not seeing what kind of rods they are. They're maybe better compared to the climbing rods that help tomato plants to grow up strong than they are to the fences that keep the horse from running free. When we violate the natural law, we're not really more free, we're less free. We become the slaves of our desires and our emotions, and we miss out on our true happiness.
Yes, a very wise man once said that freedom is not the ability to do what you want to do, but the ability to do what you should do according to God's law. And when we abandon that, we lay ourselves open for all sorts of problems. Well, we're going to be back here in just a few minutes with our special guest this afternoon. And if you'd like to give us a call, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And we are living in a society with increasing moral anarchy. How much longer can we exist that way? mm-hmm.
ever wondered about the boys we left behind in Vietnam, in Korea? Did you ever know that we left 25,000 American boys behind in Russia, in Siberia, at the end of the Second World War? Have you ever wondered what really happened in Oklahoma City, what really happened with TWA 800 on the route down off the eastern coast of Oregon? Well, ladies and gentlemen, all of the subjects are well covered in a fascinating book by Craig Roberts entitled The Medusa File. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, order The Medusa File. Actually, Craig Roberts was a police officer working on the Oklahoma City bombing. And this book has been suppressed very effectively across America, and it's self-published, but I promise you that there's no other book anywhere that will give you a more contemporary history, frightening history that every American needs to know. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR now.
Sophisticated investors are buying gold and silver today because the dollar has lost almost 50% of its value in relationship to the euro, and the price of gold and silver has increased almost 40%. If you're interested in learning more about precious metal investing, why don't you call Bo at 831-423-0177. That's 831-423-0177, or visit him at Elliott's Stamp and Coin Shop in downtown Santa Cruz at 141 South River Street in the San Lorenzo office building, which is located between Trader Joe's and the Signature Twin Movie Theater. Bo's telephone number is 831-423-0177. That's 831-423-0177. And he's located at 141 South River Street in the San Lorenzo office building. And if you mention you heard about Elliott Stamp and Coin Shop on Radio Liberty, why, you'll get a 15% discount on some non-investment items.
Leading edge dentists know the profound effect dental materials and procedures have on the health of the entire body. If you've been searching for a holistic trained dentist who can safely treat you, look no further. Dr. David Biles has been a leader in the Santa Cruz dental community for nearly 20 years. He built a solid reputation providing exceptionally high quality cosmetic and restorative dental care long before learning the very real hazards of common dental practices. Now, as a faculty member of the Institute of Natural Dentistry, Dr. Biles has begun lecturing nationally to other dentists on alternative and complementary dental care. On request, Dr. Biles will safely remove toxic dental materials from your mouth while substituting them with safe, non-allergenic restorations. Call Dr. Biles today and take the next step to improve your health. With sedation and nitrous oxide available, Dr. Biles can help even the most anxious patients. Call 423-0121 and schedule a visit now. That's 423-0121.
And we'll be back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this afternoon is Professor Budzijewski, and he's a professor of religion and politics at the University of Texas. And would you like to tell our listeners how they can get copies of your book?
Yes, I'd be glad to. There are two ways. If they order directly from the publisher, which is Spence Publishing, then they can get it at a 50% discount, which is a nice deal. They can either call toll-free, 888-773-6782, 888-773-6782, or else they can go to the website, which is www.spencepublishing.com.
All right, and they're a very good publisher. We've had very good relations. They have a lot of fascinating books. Well, how is your message accepted by college students today? I mean, you're teaching in the college, and young people don't want to be told what to do. They think that they're so smart. And of course, this is a time, a very difficult time of life, because you really don't have much knowledge, but you like to think you have a lot of knowledge, and you like to talk about all these intellectual things. But unless you really understand the history of philosophy, unless you understand the history of humanity, unless you understand the teachings of the Bible, why, of course, you're really sort of an educated fool in many respects. How do these young people accept your teaching as you tell them that there really are values, and there is a right, and there is a wrong, and there are absolutes?
Well, it's surprising. You would think that that the reaction would all be rebellion. But in fact, sometimes it's just the opposite. They may or may not express it in class. Sometimes I only hear it during office hours when they think that no other students are listening. But often what I find is that there's a sort of a hunger for this, because they're not being given answers to the moral questions that make sense. They're not hearing this. They're being encouraged in rebellion, and they're getting tired of rebellion. You know, it's not countercultural anymore. It's conventional now to rebel. Their professors are into that sort of thing, too. And the counterculture now is beginning to be looking for an end to the rebellion, looking for what kind of structure actually makes sense. And when you can see that the time-honored moral rules are not just arbitrary, that there actually is a sense to them, that a rational explanation of them can be given, one in terms of not just the good of the whole human race, but even in terms of the good of the individual, and ultimately, I believe, in terms of the good of our relationship with God, then things begin to fall into place. And why shouldn't they? After all, we understand that there are rules for how to garden so that the plants will grow in a healthy way and they'll flourish. Why shouldn't there be rules about how a human being should live and conduct himself so that he will grow and live in a healthy way and his life will flourish? That is the structures of that kind of a life are called the moral rules, and the capacities of that kind of life are called the virtues. So it's like rediscovering what was there all along, but discovering it as though it were new, and it can be rather exciting for some of these students.
Well,
go ahead.
No, I was just going to say I wish I'd had a professor like you when I was going to college back in the 1940s. You know, the philosophy that I was getting then was really sort of going along and doing what you wanted to do, and absolute freedom, and of course, you know, well, we all made a lot of mistakes when we were young. But if somebody had just simply said, you know, there's certain things that you can't not know, there are absolute laws, and you break them, there's going to be serious consequences for you for the rest of your life, why you would have certainly looked at things far different.
So. I think one of the reasons that this is becoming more plausible to students today is, you know, is because they're beginning to experience the consequences so sharply of our all having violated those rules for so long, not just in their own lives, but their parents' generation, my generation, you know, your generation, and it eventually begins to come home. The bad consequences start piling up, and also just the craziness of it, the meaninglessness of it, begins to weigh on one more and more heavily. There was a student in one of my classes who said, "Yeah, I somehow or other the subject of sexuality had come up," and he said, "Yeah, I know what you're talking about." He said, "My, you know, the home of my parents broke up, and I missed my parents so much because I didn't have them both there." He said, "I really long for," he didn't say sex with everybody I can see. He said, "I really long to get married and stay married for the rest of my life." This was, you know, I didn't used to hear that 20 years ago from students. So it was very encouraging. The part that broke my life was then, that broke my heart was that he then followed that up by saying, "But I don't think it's possible." Because all he'd seen was brokenness. All he'd seen was the wreckage of other lives that had been broken by violating the rules, and he thought that that was just the way of it, that there's no choice but to just violate them all the time, that all love ends in anger and futility, and I can understand that. He didn't want to dishonor his parents, so he wanted to believe that they'd done their best. It would have been difficult to believe that people, as good as he wanted to believe his parents were, might not have done the right thing by each other or by him. I can sympathize with that. It's an honorable and a noble impulse to want to honor your parents. And we shouldn't be self-righteous about this because this is hard. But his despair was a wrong impulse and his longing was a right impulse.
Amen to that. Well, how are we going to get our society back to the rules that once, you know, were commonplace in our society, and yet, you know, after the time that I grew up in, and Kinsey and Hugh Hefner and the Playboy era, why, of course, so many people have turned their back on these traditions that once were held to be the very foundations of our society, the moral rule, as it was, or the natural law.
How do we go back? Well, this is not fashionable, but I think that what we have to do is expressed by the very, very old-fashioned word repent. We have to admit that we've been wrong, that we've been going down the wrong path, and that the only way to get back to where we needed to be, where we took the wrong turning, was to turn around 180 degrees. They say you can't turn the clock back, but I think that's exactly what we need to do. We have to reverse what we've been doing for the last two generations, and get back there and start over down the right branch of the road instead of the one that we've been on. In large part, that's going to mean admitting that we've deceived ourselves, admitting that we've often told ourselves that we were doing the best that we could when we weren't, telling ourselves, oh, this is so hard, it's so cloudy and difficult to tell what's right, when really it was perfectly clear to us, and it wasn't that we didn't know right and wrong, it was just that we wanted to pretend to ourselves that we didn't know. So we're going to have to just grit our teeth and confess all these things and really be sorry and repent and try to get about the business of moral discipline. I wish there were an easier answer. I wish that some of these therapeutic remedies that people propose instead of moral discipline, they say, well, you know, we need to lie on the couch or get some pills or something or get psychoanalyzed. That isn't going to do it. That isn't going to do it. The old virtues are what we need.
Amen to that. Well, let's go to Melissa, who's calling us from, of all places, Texas. And again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. Melissa, what part of Texas are you calling from?
Well, I'm in Austin.
Okay, fine. Well, good to have you with us.
Hello. I'm glad to talk to you both. I think one of the things that I'm seeing in the younger people that I talk to is that even though they want to believe in creationism, they're being told at school that if you have half a brain, you have to realize that this is evolution. And someone gave me a copy of a video, a DVD, called Unlocking the Mystery of Life, The Case for Intelligent Design. And it goes to the molecular structure with graphics and with, microscopic proof that there had to be a creator who designed everything right down to the smallest molecular structure. And I've showed that to several kids that I know, young people, and they immediately are thrilled because all of a sudden it's okay to be smart and believe in creation.
Well, how would you respond to that, Professor?
Yes, I think that the intelligent design movement, which she's referring to, has been a very good thing. I really agree with her completely. I avoid the term creationism myself. It's not because I don't believe in creation. I do. But when people hear that word creationism, they start getting ideas in their mind from movies like Inherit the Wind, you know, all those stereotypes that you've got a bunch of yokels who don't know anything and who are just slapping their Bibles and saying the Bible says and not wanting to learn or use their minds. In fact, the intelligent design movement, although some of the people in it are religious believers and believe the biblical account and so forth, others are not. There are even atheists in the movement who have reluctantly admitted that the evidence itself, the scientific evidence, points to some kind of design. Some of them will say, in particular the atheists, they'll say, well, we can't imagine who the designer is. but they say the evidence does point to design of some sort, and it just can't be ignored. This is a matter of scientific evidence. Most of those who wrap the intelligent designers as numbskulls, anti-scientific and so forth, say that because they haven't actually investigated the evidences that are proposed. It seems to me that the blind faith here is not on the side of the intelligent design people. The blind faith is what you find on the part of the Darwinists, because when the evidence is against you and you insist on that your way is right anyway, there's something blind about that, and that's what we find at this stage of the scientific debate.
Well, Melissa, it is so difficult when you've been schooled and indoctrinated in the theory of evolution, and of course you've been taught this in university and you've been taught it in high school. It's so difficult to challenge that and say, hey, there's something wrong with this. It takes a long time to get through to these young people. And if you can just ask them questions, if you have a good video, that's wonderful. Or just ask your professor, where did life come from? Well, he's going to tell you, well, it came from outer space. And that's it. And then, well, where did the life in outer space come from? And, of course, he doesn't have an answer to any of these things. He certainly doesn't want to have to come up with the answers himself. He just wants to attack the other side. And it's the oldest trick in the world. You always want to put the enemy on the defensive. And the enemy, of course, is those of us who believe in God. And we said don't have to be on the defensive. It takes an awful lot more faith to believe in evolution than it does to believe that God created the heavens and the earth.
Yes, I think that's true. There are also a couple of other things that are important here. One is that there is a sort of a verbal trick that's used. When people say evolution, they will slide back and forth sometimes between two different meanings of that phrase. Now, one of the meanings of that phrase is that there's evidence that first there were simpler forms of life and later there were more elaborate forms of life and that it all took a long time. Well, that hypothesis is actually compatible with design. It may have been a process of design that took a long, long time. That's something for the empirical evidence to settle. But the other meaning of evolution that people use is that there was no design, is that it was all a godless, purposeless, meaningless process just by chance. Even if the former hypothesis were true, that this all took a long time and there were earlier organisms and later organisms and there were some changes, the other meaning of evolution doesn't follow from that. We have to keep them straight. And that's why I like to, just like I like to avoid the word creationism, I like to avoid the word evolution because it's ambiguous. Instead, I'll say if I'm talking about the explanation of how it happened that I'm objecting to, I'll say Darwinism. And if I'm talking about just the idea that it took a long time, well, I'll say that. I'll say descent from a common ancestor or something like that. That's one thing that's important. And I think the other thing is just to point out that, after all, in most other spheres of life and spheres of science and art and investigation, we do believe that we can detect the signs of purposefulness. You know, these CD astronomers, for instance, they listen to radio signals coming in from outer space on their radio telescopes, on the chance that possibly there might be some civilization out there trying to communicate with us, and they use complicated computer programs in order to try to sort out signals that might be meaningful from things that are just produced by the laws of nature or by chance processes. Now, they're assuming that they can detect design. If you can detect design in the pattern of a radio signal, why couldn't you detect design in the molecular structure of our own cells? It's the same logic that it works in both cases, and it's a purely empirical process. It's just reasoning from the evidence, and it doesn't really have anything to do, necessarily, with what you believe or don't believe about the Bible.
Anything else you wanted to say, Melissa?
Well, here in Austin, at our infamous Access Television Studios, is the oldest running atheist show on television every Sunday. And they've actually, I don't think they have it on the religious channel that is on Access. But boy, those guys get up there, and two of them were actually sons of ministers. And they are just so sure of themselves, and they just are so haughty. And if you try to tell them about intelligent design and how you can prove it, it's like, no, don't confuse me with the facts.
Well, I think sometimes you do better by asking questions than lecturing. What do you think about that, Professor?
I think that's true. You can ask questions that people haven't thought of draw their attention to the holes in their explanations. I also don't think that you have to worry too much about the things that are going on Access.
True. We have a very active Access channel here in Austin. It's quite a large movement.
Do you think that a lot of people really watch it?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, well.
Dr. Stan, that's where Alex Jones got his start here in Austin on Access. So.
All right, but
what I'm saying.
But he was on the other side, wasn't he?
Oh, you bet.
Okay. Fine, though. Thank you so very much,
Melissa.
Thank you. Okay, bye-bye. Well, of course, the people all across the country are concerned about the same things that you are. And, of course, I think that your book is really it is a philosophical discussion. But, you know, as I get older and older, I learn more and more, and I can appreciate a book such as yours because it's so beautifully written, and it raises those questions and thoughts that people need to have at the tip of their tongue so that they can counter the arguments from the other side. Well, we've got about a minute, just a little over a minute, before I have to let you go. What are your parting thoughts for our listeners today?
Well, I think our parting thoughts would just be to remember that there are some things that we can't not know, that it's impossible not to know, that even the skeptic, even the rebel, even the person who denies that there is any moral law really does know them deep down. Even a lot of what presents itself as moral ignorance, people saying, oh, it's just cloudy, who knows what's right, who knows what's wrong, is really not that. It's self-deception. We know better.
And if that's the title of the book is What We Can't Not Know. What We Can't Not Know. And it's a tongue twister, but if you stop and think about it, it's really so true. Those moral truths are there, and we all know them. We may reject them, but the book is well worthwhile reading. God bless you. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Bye-bye.
Set genocide, and one of the tapes is an interview with a Dr. Dunigan who heard back in 1969 actually a talk given by Dr. Day, who would later become the president of Planned Parenthood. And Dr. Day laid out the whole plan for America, the fact there are too many people, the fact that we're going to have to create new diseases, the fact that we're going to have to conceal some of the very obvious treatments for cancer, because people are going to have to die of something. You might as well die of cancer. An incredible interview and a series of other interviews that will go into the background of what is happening in America, why new diseases are cropping up all the time. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR for copies of our four-tape set, Genocide. It's vitally important that you help us to get this message out across America, because without knowledge, my people perish. America, our values, our future are under attack today.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and I want to tell you about a four-tape set we have. And if you listen to it, you'll never, ever quite look at the world through the same eyes again. There are interviews with a Dr. Dunigan. Three of them were done by Randy Engel, one I did, because I wanted to talk to Dr. Dunigan, who was a practicing pediatrician up in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And back in 1969, why he says that he had heard a talk given by Richard Day, Dr. Richard Day, who had actually been one of his teachers when he was in medical school. And Dr. Day, by this time, was the medical director of Planned Parenthood. And he got a group of doctors together at a regular meeting. They thought he was going to talk about neonatology. And instead of that, he said, turn off your tape recorders and don't take any notes. And I'm going to tell you what's really going on. I am working with a group. We call them the Order. And they have a plan, and they think there are too many people in the world, and so they're going to withhold treatments for cancer, because people are going to have to die of something, and we're going to keep these treatments hidden away so they can die of cancer, because we don't want to treat cancer. We want to say we're going to treat cancer, but we're really not going to. We're going to create new diseases that will be used for mass extermination. And he went on and talked about how they were going, of course, to have Japanese cars better than American cars and pay exorbitant salaries to the athletes. And as you read, of course, and we actually have the transcript of this. You can get the transcript of it with a four-tape set. It is the most incredible four-tape set you've ever heard. And, of course, it was just 3 months of that, and we do have the testimony of Dr. MacArthur, when he goes before the House Appropriations Committee, asks for $10 million to create a new disease that will destroy the immune system, another method of mass killing was the way he put it. Give us the money, we want to create the new disease. And just a few years later, we had something called AIDS. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. And, of course, we were just telling our listeners about the four-tape set on The New Order of the Barbarians. And if you get that tape set and the transcript that goes with it and go over it carefully, you'll understand so many of the unexplainable things that are going on in the world today, because I believe that the information here is true, and it is frightening to realize that there is this degree of evil in the world. But then, of course, that's what Dr. Brzezinski was talking about. He was talking about there really is evil in the world. How do you explain the wars of this last century, the revolutions of the last century, the great epidemics of the last century, the new diseases that suddenly are cropping up every place, the fact that they've released Vioxx when they knew it increased the incidence of heart disease 7 times? Oh, you didn't know that. Back in 1999, we have Dr. Graham's testimony before the Senate, totally blacked out by the controlled media. You didn't know, for instance, they want you to take your vaccine shots so you'll get, it'll destroy your mind. And if you like that, quotation, we'll send you the page off of Dr. Fudenberg's website. He's 80 years old. He's one of the deans of the vaccinologists. And he points out that if you are between 60 and 65 and you take your influenza shot, as your doctor tells you, three or four times over a period of 5 years, 10 years down the line, your incidence of Alzheimer's goes up 1,000%. And what do you think it does to the mind, to the brain, the developing brain of a six-month-old child that gets the same amount of mercury that the older person does that gives them the Alzheimer's disease? And then we wonder why we have autism. But you can rest assured that why the CDC and the government assures us that the mercury in the vaccines doesn't do anybody any harm at all. It's almost as if they're trying to convince us that it's good for us. And why do you think that they passed this new legislation that now you can't sue in local courts? They've got to be forced to go into federal courts, and they put limits on what you can get and what the lawyer can get. And I think there's been exorbitant settlements, but I think that now they've taken away the only means we have of redress for the fact that the incidence of autism has gone up 600% from 1 in 10,000 to 1 in 160 children. But they assure you it has nothing to do with mercury, even though we have their studies, the government studies, where they know it is. They're simply lying to you, and they're destroying the minds of our children. Well, to understand this, you really need to get my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, and we hope many of you will, if you've read the book, well, get the full case. You can get the book instead of paying $12.95 for it. Why, you can get 62 of them for $124, unless you're in California. We have to charge a tax, but any other place you can get it for $124 plus shipping, about $25. And then, of course, you can get this in other people's hands and recognize that evil is not simply an abstract idea. It is organized. It is coordinated. And it is being followed by people, in very, very powerful people who have a profound impact on every aspect of our lives today. So if you'd like to get the case of Brotherhood of Darkness, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to get the four-tape set on the New Order of the Barbarians, the story of Dr. Richard Day, the medical director of Planned Parenthood who told about the master plan of a group he called The Order, that's the New Order of the Barbarians, the four-tape set, and you can get the transcript for that one. It's the only one we really have a transcript for. And then, of course, we do hope that many of you will give serious consideration to getting my new video. It's called Nundare College Genocide, where I go into all of the things that they're doing to harm the health of your children. And then, of course, Bill Sardi's excellent talk at our last seminar. That video is available now, too, and you'll just have to ask for Bill Sardi's video. We'll have to get the name of it. But our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. We're involved in an epic struggle to determine whether this nation or any nation conceived under God can long endure. Look around and see what's happening. As we move towards World War III, as our society is progressively corrupted, as well as our children, pray for America, pray for revival, please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection, until tomorrow. May the Lord be with you.